Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, it's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately. And speaking of provocations, things that will not stand, we have our first Waypoint this week, which apparently Patrick just really wanted to get something off his chest about the Slate political gabfest. Patrick, why did you make me listen to David Plotz again after my glorious 10-year hiatus?
Man. Okay, so let me set up the Slate Political Gabfest a little bit. So it's a podcast from the publication Slate. I guess it's been going since 2005. I probably joined in around 2008. I'll get to that part because it's sort of an important part of the reason I even have brought this up at all. And it's just, it is an early podcast, right? Like, well, part of the reason it is important and foundational in sort of like the larger podcast text is because, like, it was a time when there weren't a lot of podcasts happening. And part of the reason it's popular and institutional is because 2005 was a really early time to like start recording like conversational thoughts about anything. That stuff that happened in meetings and podcasts kind of have, you know, didn't really come into their own until years later. The three hosts have been pretty much a constant, I think, since the beginning, at least certainly when I started listening to John Dickerson, who is a political writer reporter, who was, I think, a columnist at Slate. Then in the last like 5 years or so became a co-host and then host of Face the Nation, one of like the institutional Sunday shows along like Meet the Press. And now he is one of the three hosts on CBS's morning show, which I don't know if that's the
Face
name
the
of
Nation,
it.
I think.
No. Face the Nation is the Sunday show. He's also on the morning show.
Is he on the morning show now?
Yeah. He took the spot when What's-His-Face got booted for being a shit egg.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, he's on the morning show. Yeah. And still does a really great a podcast every couple of weeks about presidential history. Yes, Whistle Stop. Emily Bazelon, who also a Slate writer, who is now one of them, a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine, has a legal background and is frequently like takes the position on if Dickerson is like the contextual historian, then Emily Bazelon is sort of like the legal sort of corner. And then part of the reason we're getting to this whole waypoint is David Plotz, who was a writer at Slate, became an editor at Slate, and now is off doing some cultural travel thing called Atlas Obscura.
Hey, don't diss Atlas Obscura.
I don't know anything about it. I'm not dismissing it. I don't know anything about it. I just know that's what he's doing now. I don't have an opinion on Atlas Obscura. I just know it has lists. That's like the only thing I know about it, and that may be
I'm surprised
reductive.
Rob is the Atlas Obscura apologist after his bit last week about going hard on like things that make you feel smart, things that make you feel like you've seen the world, because that's Atlas Obscura's entire bit.
Yeah, but I think they're doing a better job of, in general, like when their stuff like crosses onto my radar, it's doing a better job of finding stuff that I legitimately have not encountered before.
Okay.
And isn't like the American Supreme Court, which you can read a fucking Wikipedia article on without the aid of a musical, and you'll be just fine and probably come away with better understanding.
If that's true, then maybe we would have had different election results in 2016, because people would have known how important the Supreme Court was. So
anyway, here's Lin-Manuel Miranda to explain...
They didn't even get it. Okay.
I was like, is that an episode I didn't listen to of More Perfect? Because it wouldn't shock me, because that would definitely fit the... Anyway, so it's just a roundtable, three topics sort of thing. It's reasonably popular. The reason this Slate Political Gabfest is important to me is because around the time that I started paying attention to politics, like follows the rise of Obama into presidential politics, and when the home I had for politics was not part of my life growing up. Like, family didn't talk about it, friends didn't talk about it. Like, that says a lot about my life growing up, in addition to just it was not something that was at the dinner table, it wasn't around friends, and it was something that with the election and rise of Obama, like, I just became more interested. I was like, this is a fascinating thing. I was coming into my own in my 20s, just like a larger awareness of things in general. Had my first full-time job working out at 1UP in San Francisco, and so I wanted to learn more about politics, and I found a home on pre-reset era NeoGAF, you know, then was, might have been the Gaming Age forums then. I don't know if the switch had happened at that point, but they had a, you know, they have a gaming forum, an off-topic forum, and then a, like, niches forum. And so it's like the politics, you know, thread was there. And I was just, I didn't know where to go to find any political discussion. So I started on the forum that I was on every day,
right,
as part
already
of my daily habits, sure, and like fell into a community there. And I don't know if that's where I picked up on the Slate Political Gabfest. I was not reading Slate regularly. It was not like a part of my daily sort of media consumption. I think I might have done something as simple as gone into iTunes, searched political, and just like downloaded a couple. And like this one clicked, and like those three became like the beginning of me having like a language for politics, having it something where it is viewed as both sport and something deeper than just occasionally something you see a headline of or you vote every 4 years. And I have continued to listen to the Slate Political Gabfest in addition to a whole wide range of things as podcasts have become like a, in many ways, my like primary media of taking a lot of news and analysis in. And despite the fact that I have grown to despise huge and get so angry listening week after week, and a lot of this is centered around David Plotz, so we can get into that bit as we transition out of my extremely long intro. But I just wanted to set the foundation of like it's both an institutional podcast and also institutional to my own foundational understanding of politics as my way in. And so it's been something I've refused to give up because these people have become the same way that people talk to me about like the Bombcast or something like these are just like friends I listen to talking about topics each week. Like the Political Gabfest like largely became that for me, and have then once you've done it for 10 years, mm-hmm, I found it increasingly hard to give up because it's just one of those, it's just this thing I do every week. I listen to what they have to say about three topics from the news that week. And this has followed this increasing, it definitely has become far more sharp and aware in the last, basically post 2016, I would say. And this has been true for a long time, but I think it's been more sharp in the last couple of years, in which David Plotz, Rob wrote the segment title as,
uh-huh,
David Plotz, retire bitch. Because it sounds like, Rob, you fell off and I brought you back in. Austin, it sounds like if you don't listen as frequently as I do, it is at least something that is part of what you've listened to regularly as part of at least your own hit podcast history.
My own podcast history, definitely, definitely. I would say when I was in Canada, it became important for me because it was a lot harder to pay attention to just what is happening this week. So I spent like 4.5 years in Canada from like 2011 through 2015. Something like that. So that is when I picked up the podcast. I'd listened to a few episodes here and there prior to that, but that was the period during which I really fell in. It was like in the lead up to Obama's second campaign and like what was happening there. And so that became a way for me to just stay grounded and connected to the Democratic Party, but also to just like what is happening in Washington. The thing that's interesting to me is like that was also a period of time during which my politics were going further to the left of them. And so it ended up being a podcast that kept me grounded with what the mainstream arguments sounded like. And
it's a center left podcast. Like, we should center that up. Like it is like David Plotz is center.
Yeah, yeah.
Emily Bazelon appears that she's slowly being radicalized.
Very slowly. We're bringing her over.
Very slowly. Still center left. And John Dickerson calling them both. Got to hear both sides is not true. I think at his worst, he can be got to hear both sides. At his mm-hmm. best, he is like a contextual historian in which he's trying to broaden out like what is actually happening here. I think he can fall into both sides of them because of his reporting history.
Context. Yeah.
But it is usually from, he's usually approaching that from a good faith perspective as opposed to just like, well, we got to consider what the Republicans have to say. So it's left leaning, but not, It is not 2018 left-leaning. It is very much institutional, establishment, center-left. Says they're left, but really is more
It's liberal.
Center.
It's a liberal podcast. Yes. By which,
it's not progressive. It's liberal.
Right. If we want to make like the contemporary split in the Democratic Party, in the American left wing of thought, it is liberal, which means it has a fundamental faith in markets. It has a fundamental faith in the stat. Rob? Rob, that's liquor.
What up?
That's not a beer. A beer, Rob. It is 1:35 p.m.
Oh, I
not
got this one waiting on the flight deck, baby.
This is unhealthy. It's not. I can't.
Look, between this and Austin, we have to talk about the Cleveland Browns after this. So
you just turn off the podcast now. Honestly, this is. So yeah, it has been part of my history, but over the last few years, okay. God, I don't want to just go in. We shouldn't just go in yet.
I still want to set up a little bit about this arc because I think it's important.
So for me, one of the things that has made me listen less recently, I got to a point where I was listening every week, especially in the lead up to 2016's election and in the fallout after that, because it was a sort of meditative salve in which I was spending an hour a week just deeply immersing myself in the voices of other people who were upset. Right.
Yeah.
Though in the lead up to 2016, especially, it was also the lead up of people who thought they had it in the bag. There was this real. I found a tweet from myself from weeks prior where it seemed like prior to the election, where I was kind of characterizing their entire attitude as like, you know, well, we won that one. We knocked that one out of the park. What's next? And that was very much the attitude. You know, there was concern about the rise of Trumpism in America. But around that time is when Plotz specifically became a complete thorn in my side. Not just someone who had takes that I disagreed with, but someone who had a wildly different understanding of what good government looked like and who was dismissive of critique from the left, critique from questions of from positions often of identity and from the margins. And just kind of became a roiling asshole on the show. I don't know him personally.
Became.
You know? Well, right. So this is the thing is there were other moments where I think it just slipped off my – like he just washed off my back like rain on a water-coated beautiful
you
sedan,
needed,
which
you
I am.
You needed to catch him in one of those this is my goddamn show moments.
Right.
But unlike back in the heyday of One Up Yours, that moment comes from Plotz like twice an episode. But mm-hmm. some of them are worse than others, and some of them are like, whoa, there's like a weird vibe to the way he interacts with people who are ostensibly his peers.
Yeah.
And that also changes how he relates to political discussion, right? Like, it honestly, like, the person he reminds me the most of is Bill Maher, if you see Bill Maher on Real Time.
Yeah.
Sort of 100%. The instinctive, like, the move toward domineering approaches to conversation in a way that can be very bullying if he does not like what he's hearing or if he's getting pushback when he feels he shouldn't. But like, I think it is worth checking in on this podcast because this is a discourse I have largely lost touch with. This is not how I tended to follow politics. My preferred mode, of course, was to go to the Athenaeum once a week and sit in the reading room and catch up on the Spectator and the New Inquiry. But going back to something like this, it is interesting to me, especially if you spend a lot of time in the Waypoint water cooler reality distortion sphere. In some ways, where like, yeah, this leftist discourse, this is like commonplace.
We got the
upgrade
from the echo chamber, is what you're telling me. We got the XCOM. We put an extra engineer in there, and so now we got up to the reality distortion chamber. Fuck the echo chamber.
Right, but Patrick forced us into that cell we keep in the bottom of the Avenger, where they're trying to torture you into becoming a psychic, because this is kind of how I think people end up. Getting poisoned a little bit by centrism. And it is interesting, even people whose politics and biases they think pulled them toward progressivism, this is a very center-left podcast in ways that I find enormously revealing and instructive for why liberalism tends to lack a like concrete political agenda, why it tends to like lack a focus toward political ends. And I think you can see a lot of that and hear a lot of it in the way people interact on the GabFest, particularly in the episode Patrick pulled.
Right. So really quickly, I think that's incisive and insightful, Rob. I think that, like, that hitting that element of liberalism, which we'll wrap back around in centrism, specifically with liberalism, the idea of, like, there is not an end. There is only the creation of a stage on which outcomes can be achieved. There's the belief in a sort of equality of opportunity, not an equality of outcome. And the idea that once we are all fair actors, the outcome will be beneficial. And you do see that on this stage. And I also think specifically, to, as we get into this conversation, what's important to look for are the times at which that premise falls apart, or not the premise that you've put forward, but that idea that that is what they are trying to achieve falls apart because of how it misserves certain communities. And also just because eventually someone is like defaults to or decides to pursue a sort of got mine attitude, or a, well, this is the way it's done, or takes over a conversation defaulting to like their authority, which has been given to them by an unfair stage to begin with. So that is all I wanted to say before we do get to this episode, which I'm glad Patrick made me listen to, I guess.
Well, Patrick had to mourn the passing of a great American, and he did it the only way he knew how, which was a GabFest.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's been a subplot to this that got me to this point, which is there's an episode some number of weeks back in which the National Review writer, columnist, critic, whatever, David French, shitbag, who like quoted me in an article once, which was very, very good. And then I switched my name to start trolling him in the article because he embedded the tweet and then it changes the name. It was good. Anyway, they had him on because they, one of the things that the GabFest tends to do is they have continually participated in this notion of trying to find the reasonable Republican. They have found this, like, both through David French, who, and also Ross Doubt. Is that how you pronounce his last name? The New York Times opinion columnist?
We
know who I'm talking about, right? I've never pronounced it that way, but yes. Well, it's important that we reference... that's how I've always said it, but maybe it is Doubt. Like, I don't know.
I want to say it's Doubt because I want to say that's what they said. I could be wrong, but I want to say they pronounced it Doubt. Anyway, if I'm getting it wrong, but
Doubt.
Yeah. Right? So he,
you already know who he is.
Yeah. You may not know who he is, but you've seen people ragging on one of his columns. He is one of the regular, you know, Barry Weiss, of that triumvirate that is, although I think he's been at the New York Times opinion page a lot longer. Anyway,
yeah,
like,
he's better than her average, because he predates her.
So they've had Ross on, they've had David French on, and like, what's interesting is, like, in the larger context of what it must be like to record a podcast for like 10 plus years with the same groups of people, in which you probably fall into habits in which you often don't push back on the people that you're speaking with because you fall into a habitual, comfortable, conversational tone. In the conversations they've had with like Ross, no one really pushes back on what he has to say despite having some really reprehensible opinions because they all seem to be like buddy-buddy friends in real life. Not the case with David French, but what you get is David Plotz, the establishmentarian stan, constantly deferring to David French as someone reasonable. And what happened in that episode was Emily Bazelon being constantly, and basically John Dickerson, usually when things get contentious, John Dickerson just sort of like fades to the background and like kind of lets the two of them work it out. And in that specific David French episode, like Emily just like brought out the knives and was just like not having it. I thought
this
it was like,
is
really
talking about the Kavanaugh hearings.
Yes, the Kavanaugh hearings, and I can't remember what the other topics were. It might have been the whole podcast. And especially, you know, Emily coming from a legal background and she is specialized in, you know, assault and bullying and things like that. Like she was, you know, clearly coming from her corner, and she just was not having it. It was just interesting because it was one of the few times where you see sort of like the comfortable facade drop and you see actual combative discourse occurring. And I found that to actually be like interesting, right? Like I may not want to read David French's columns, but I'm interested in hearing someone like meaningfully take it to someone like that. But it doesn't usually happen between the actual podcast hosts. And so this gets us to, I think, last week's episode in which the first topic was sort of like, oh, what do we make of George H.W. Bush and like more broad reaching, like how do we, you know, discuss figures like this. And, you know, David Plotz does his, you know, a big memoriam for George H.W. Bush, and like, oh, we should remember him for X, Y, and Z. And there's like this long pause, and then like Emily Bazelon just, I think she has like one line that is maybe a little bit like amicable, and then just fucking goes down the laundry list yep. of like all of his shitty misdeeds, Willie Horton, AIDS, blah, 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 blah. Like, we don't need to get into that here. Like, there's plenty of articles to do a better job, particularly that.
And you should look them up. If you don't know.
You don't know. Like, yes, like, Mr. Reasonable is like, nah, he just exported all of his bullshit. Also, he voted against, like, the Civil Rights Act.
There's a lot.
So she goes through that laundry list as basically, like, a giant, like, fuck you to this idea that, like, we need to give him 24 hours before we, like, fully understand, like, this man's history and, like, the wrongs that he did upon people, often for his own political gain. And Plotz just, like, the most... just guffaws in
the monocle flying across the room.
He literally should says, listen to it, because I cannot even read the transcript, but uh-huh. like, you need to listen to that bit to like you really like to understand
it's
it. But if you have
10 minutes, it's less than 10 minutes into this episode, yeah. people, but he just goes like, man, that was a harsh take, dude. You said one nice thing about the dude, and it was about how he was a kind of a wimp you could like. Because that was a thing that she said, was that, like,
yeah.
he did not present this idea of, like, chest-beating masculinity the way we imagine all male presidents should do, goddammit.
Right.
No, not just all male presidents. I you know, even when Hillary was running, she was putting yeah. on her, like, best chest-thumping rah-rah. Yes. Not that she isn't hawkish also, and is that she is that person.
But in terms of, like, the masculine-facing persona embedded in, like, sort of presidential politics.
He completely said, that wasn't my take at all. Like, just completely shocked by the idea of bringing up this dude's many, many, many misdeeds in a way, which then, of course, leads John Dickerson to try to, like, contextualize, in a very Dickersonian moment, mm-hmm. to try to, like, contextualize everything. And, hey, listen, okay, well, is there a way? There's a point at which John Dickerson, okay, do you want to do it, Rob? Do you want to bring up his suggestion? Okay.
Solution. Rob is solution. Holy shit. Like, this is, you know, I don't.
So,
I don't.
The problem. The question, at least. I'll give you the question so that you can give the solution. The question John Dickerson wants to pose is, okay, in our private lives, we know that when you go to a funeral for a family member, you don't bring out the shit. You don't open the closet and say, here are the skeletons, because people are grieving. Everyone has skeletons. You don't bring it out. But George H.W. Bush, like all presidents, is a public figure, and certainly there needs to be some way to hold those people accountable and to do a complete context. I love context, as I'm John Dickerson. Context-filled mm-hmm. accounting of their lives, the good and the bad. But I just don't, how could I possibly, is there a time frame? Is there something? Rob, what is his proposed solution?
This is where I don't generally fuck with, like, the whole, you know, liberalism or centrism rots your brain. It's a brain parasite. In general, I'm like, you're not going to find me on Twitter saying that shit. But when John Dickerson says, you know, perhaps John McCain could have been done something like this. Maybe he could have pulled it off. Where you appoint somebody you trust and respect to give that more honest speech and that full accounting of both the good and the bad in your life and you as a person. Maybe that's how we could do this.
Maybe we could have just given appointed someone you believe has your best interest at heart.
John McCain's going to get up there and go, this man let AIDS victims die because he did not want to recognize it was a disease that went beyond gay people.
But
John McCain.
That is not all he did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Point number one.
Point number two, he short killed a whole bunch of brown people who were civilians, which I, as John McCain, actually think is a good thing. It is absurd. It is.
Well, it's this long walk around the how they're trying to avoid the fact that Bazelon's basically right. There is, and this is also like the Glenn Greenwald argument as well, which is that there is a very dishonest and frequently grotesque ritual of whitewashing and public mourning around powerful American figures that completely erases the violence that they either directly caused or allowed to be perpetrated in their name or the name of the United States. And there is no excuse for the moment one of these people passes to immediately pretend that they are some sainted, beloved, non-controversial American figure who we should all revere, because that is just not true for so many people. And also, in politics, these are dangerous lies to believe. These are dangerous lies to promulgate, no matter who just fucking kicked the bucket. And the solution Dickerson comes up with is laughable, because basically it means, you know, somebody else from the establishment who hasn't died, you go to them, your bro, and be like, you're always real with me. Can you be real during my funeral oration? Like, that's
America.
Yeah. And like, sure, I can do that. That's a joke.
So, and it's in the context of the McCain thing is important, because like the way they bring that up is like, oh, the path forward is like, oh, well, just because John McCain took like a pot shot at Trump at the end by not inviting him to the funeral, and then his daughter, Meghan McCain, like using a speech in which she is repudiating Trump, like, through eulogizing her father, like, that whitewashes all of John McCain's shit in the process. Like, that's not an actually go anywhere towards solving it.
So there is a thing here that Dickerson says that I think is right. Like, Dickerson's lead up is like, you can walk the garden path with him until it gets to this point, which is, I think there's a point at which where he's saying the problem with doing this is that it whitewashes the presidency. It whitewashes positions of power in public service in such a way that it encourages us to think about them in a non-problematic sense, to canonize them. And he is right about that. Like, when you do this, it prevents us from holding accountable people and from understanding these roles as ones in which the people who get elected to them are going to do things that we despise. And needing to, like, struggle with that and wrestle with that inside of a democracy is key to understanding how those rules function and how to change things so that from now on, presidents who get elected are going to be ordering drone strikes. Until someone, like, runs on that promise and then, like, you know, sunsets that program, it is going to continue happening. And as long as we don't... If Obama died tomorrow, I would be the first one saying that motherfucker killed a lot of people with drones. That motherfucker, deported more people than his predecessor, who was famous for hating immigrants, right? And running on those campaign promises. The fact that we need to have those conversations so that we can push politics in a better direction. To not have those conversations and to put up these figures as saints is to limit our political imaginations in such a way that we've already seeded the conversation, that we've already given over to the world, like, a vision of America that is lesser than we'd ever want it to be in our hearts. And, like, there's no reason to do that. Like, when a president dies, just like any other political figure in the world, we have a responsibility to think through what they did. And to fail to do, I know we said we didn't want to do the George H.W. Bush episode here, but here we are. Like, to fail to do that, the fact that we don't do that proves the thing I was saying before, which is that when liberals, which I mean both in terms of the liberal center-left wing of the center wing of the Democratic Party, and also neoliberals who are, you know, right, center-right. Far-right ends up doing a whole other situation right now. We talk about, you know, kind of anti-globalism, blah, 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 which we can get into another day. But this idea of the market, the free market, the global market, the marketplace of ideas, not just the market where things are bought and sold, but where ideas are you know, come into conflict with each other, where ideas are challenged, and where, oh, if you have the conflict of smart people, just debate me, bro. That liberal core idea is thrown away. All day they'll say, "Duh, if the good ideas will win out." Motherfucker, then let me say how bad this dude was, and you can say how good he was, and we'll see who wins the day. Because I know who George H.W. Bush killed. It was a lot of people. It was a lot of people. And if you can't confront that, then your entire premise, the idea that good ideas win the day, is full of shit. And you know it's full of shit.
Well, and that, I think, points to, like, who are these positions taken for? What exactly. Is it serving? And I think this is where, like, that episode, I believe, ends with a shout out to the Weekly Standard. To the homies over at the Weekly Standard. Hope y'all land on your feet. Hire these good people. Yep. This conservative, respectable conservative propaganda outlet is about to shutter because it's no longer serving as a useful front for the fucking Mercer class billionaires who have discovered that just straight up white nationalism just plays way better and will actually win elections.
Yep.
So that's why the Weekly Standard is getting flushed down the fucking toilet. But it ends with them sort of giving a shout out to the Weekly Standard because fundamentally these are, and again, this is more terminology I tend to like try to resist, like the village, the idea that like DC and the Northeast like political class tend to be deeply parochial and have the dynamics of a small town where everybody fundamentally is part of the same community, shares a lot more common interests and values than is encompassed in their politics. And so when push comes to shove, like when there's a death of a political figure, it is a death in this family. It is a death in this small community.
Yep.
And this class of people who ostensibly position themselves as experts on American politics, as people who will tell you what is actually happening in the halls of power and who is affected, when something like real happens to someone in the political classes, particularly like a powerful figure like an ex-president, immediately people like the hosts of the Gabfest turn into respectable mourners. They turn into rhetorical pallbearers.
Uh-huh.
And they completely abandon any pretense of objectivity or like cool analysis of the facts, and immediately join in the ritual as if they're mourners at a funeral. And that should also, and I think that is illuminating, because I don't think it is as selective as we don't do this at a funeral.
Right.
I think they're pulling those punches all the time. I think plots like engineers these discussions a lot to pull those punches and doesn't press on this stuff. Like one of the things that they really embrace, they fucking love, is like technocratic obscuritist language, legalese. The French episode is useful to look at for this, because Bazelon's pushing back on it right and left. But basically, this is at the height of the disgusting hearings around Brett Kavanaugh and Dr. Blasey Ford. And David French there is arguing that we should apply the standards of a criminal proceeding to the Kavanaugh hearings. And he is again and again like throwing out all this language that is familiar from courts of law as to what burdens of proof are, what the standards of evidence are. And what Plotz never points out is that the Senate hearing or confirmation hearing is not a criminal proceeding. Like, we do not hold standards of evidence to any other hear that you're talking shit behind my back, or you find out that, like, you know, you come home and your kid has, like, completely fucking demolished the living room, you don't immediately say, but, you know, I couldn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this happened. Obviously, I don't think I could convince a jury of my peers that this is indeed the case. I don't think I meet that burden of proof. Therefore, I am obligated to do nothing. I cannot react to what is evident to everybody in the room. I'm just going to play dumb. That's the game French plays, is I don't want, like, what French ultimately wants is to put a conservative on the Supreme Court. And his mode of doing that is to throw up this smokescreen of, well, really, like, is this really knowable in a court of law? Is this a fact you can establish? I just don't think so. I'm when I work in a prosecutor's office, this is never something that would pass muster. And Plotz lets it pass because fundamentally, Plotz likes that logic.
Plotz loves smoke screens, right? Like, this is Plotz, the defender of the swamp, all swamps. Please, more backroom deals. Please, more old boys clubs. More secret handshakes and rooms filled with cigar smoke. You know, I think
he's like constantly, he's like regularly argued about like removing like the establishment of senators from the people because maybe they just don't understand.
100%.
Like, he's one of those.
He's someone
who... even in that same discussion where the second topic they have talking about wasps is like... And
oh, we didn't even get there. Go ahead, set that up, please.
Well, they have this the segment based on Ross Doubt editorial in the New York Times.
Ross Doubt, shitty cover band.
And I'll profess to not having a, like, that was the first time I'd really heard the term WASP. Like, I was not familiar with this as, like, a...
Oh, wow. Okay. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant is what it
is. Yeah,
not...
Yeah, like a certain establishment background in which, like, most of the elites come from. Like, I mean, I understood that as, like, a general concept, not, like, as a terminology. So anyway, like, Ross, like, you know, is doing a piece sort of eulogizing, like, the death of this, you know.
George H.W. Bush, the late the last great WASP president, is the kind of pitch of that piece from Ross, Ross Doubt, and is making the case that, like, Ross is making the case that, like, well, why shouldn't there be an almost
an elite
ordained
class that
elite?
Just, like...
yeah, they have the best schools. They go to the best schools. They have the best... Their families are together still, certainly. It's like those, like, boom, boom, boom. All those hits keep coming. Like, oh, if they are the most... If they are the best school, if they have the connections already, then let them govern us. Noblesse oblige. Like,
hey,
ah, yes.
Just FYI, David Plotz went to an elite WASP private school. Don't, like, just throw that out there. Like, it's not a big deal or anything, but, like, he went there.
But yes, yes, yes.
Like, he knew those kids. He went to school with them in an elite, you know, WASP private school. Again, like, just offhand fact, little fact. Don't mean anything by it. Just, you know, I went to an elite private school, though. Just got to make sure you know.
And in that conversation, you know, he sets up, like, I mean, his premise is basically, like, maybe, like, it is better if we are ruled by, like, a preordained elite class. Maybe the rest of society doesn't actually know how to do that. And, like, Emily, like, left aghast again, sort of, like, responds with, like, the fuck you talking about,
amazing.
Man? Like, are you, like, saying, like, marginalized people and folks from different, like, just other people shouldn't have a say in how the fuck we are all governed? And it's one of the few times where he's directly, even in the George W. Bush exchange, like, H.W. Bush exchange, like, he's not directly needled as much as Emily is, like, just bringing up her own response. Yeah. Like, Emily responds and basically, like, takes the mask off of his own argument using the flowery language that he often hides behind and, like, reveals a very dark, like, underbelly to, like, Plotz's rhetoric that has always been there but has never been, like, truly unmasked to the degree that, like, I found in that exchange where he, like, finds himself on his heels and, like, It was a really revealing exchange, I thought.
So, the thing that there's so much there that is worth getting into. This idea, this nostalgia for the reign of the Northeastern WASP. Mm-hmm. And Romney is from that class, by the way. Like, his family roots go back to Michigan.
What are you talking about that there hasn't been? Like, yeah, sorry, continue.
Right.
Yes.
But I think...
Fired up right now, Rob.
Yeah. There is this, like, retroactive nostalgia for the role of, like, predominantly wealthy Northeastern families, particularly, like, you know, Mayflower type crowds that you could identify, that they would be in all the higher like, you would find them not only in high elected office consistently generation across generation, but you would also find them near the top of any meaningful government government institutional hierarchy. This is, you know, how you end up with the Dulleses, you know, folks like that. And I understand maybe the appeal of having nostalgia for that if you don't think about it for a half second. Like, if the idea of, if politics right now frightens you, and having such a boorish creep like Trump and all his hangers-on scares you, I can see why you would be nostalgic for the rule of people who, generally as a class, tended to at least sound a little bit more restrained, sound a little bit more polished, look a little more and talked a little more like people you find.
Respectability politics. Like, that's what Plotz wants through and through. He's like, just, you know, like, fuck black people, but, like, just don't say that out loud. Mm-hmm.
But
run the Willie Horton ad, but you, as long as you're the one who didn't technically approve the Willie Horton.
A political consult, a pact did that.
I was looking at me. Yeah, exactly.
Well, and the other part of this is then though they turn around and man, just such a life of service. All this, like, admiration for just the pure public service of a character like Bush. And you heard this applied to McCain a lot. And McCain's father was famously an admiral in World War II. And the thing I often find myself thinking about is, even the occupying those positions of service, getting appointments to a lot of military academies, often does involve being a little bit connected. Certainly doesn't help. Certainly doesn't hurt. Having a career like being highly placed in the civil service for years and years, that those predominantly were posts occupied by well-connected elites. And I thought a lot about this movie. I didn't remember particularly liking when it came out, but it's one of those things that has stuck with me for ages. It's De Niro's The Good Shepherd, which is about James Angleton at the CIA, who was sort of the head of counterintelligence for years and years, and is sort of this infamous figure. But there's this scene where Angleton, the CIA operative who's a Skull and Bones member, definitely one of those Northeastern WASPs, is talking to Joe Pesci, trying to arrange some deal about Cuba, and Joe Pesci's a mobster. And Joe Pesci points out to him, you know, Irish have their homeland, you know, Italians have the church. And he turns to him and is like, what do your people have? What connects you? And the Angleton character responds, "We have the United States of America, and the rest of you are just visiting." And that is a line that has sort of haunted me ever since, because I think when we talk about the service that folks like that tended to render the country, it's a proprietary service. This is the family business, and you work in the family business, and maybe you start on the ground floor, but you're going to move up, and you're going to be running the show someday. And the culmination of that was George W. Bush, a man who never had any real qualifications, never showed any capacity for government or understanding of complicated issues. But by God, he was a Bush. By God, he was one of them. And that is what that system gets you in the end. And Plotz looks at that and is reverent for it. Mm-hmm. Because, well, say what you will, at least they served. At least in the midst of all the awful things they did, all their egregious fuck-ups, all the people who died along the way to forward their careers and to make them look tough or service their agenda, at least they looked like they gave a damn about the country. And wasn't that a fine thing?
It is. You know, I know we have to move on to another topic, the Cleveland Browns. They're a whole different type of American tragedy. But... for me, one of the last things I really wanted to get to here, I'm just trying to get my thoughts together. There's actually a whole other clip we have to at least talk about because Rob linked us to another thing. In fact,
yeah, I wish we had said it earlier to set up like the like bizarre cruelty of David Plotz.
Yeah. You know,
maybe we'll just end with that quote.
I guess so. I'm all over the place right now. I'm trying to bring it back. I had a very particular point that I wanted to make that I've now lost.
Do you want me to give you a second? I'll bring up something else and maybe it'll come back.
Yeah, you bring up something else and maybe it'll come back.
I guess one of my last thoughts is just I both continue to listen to this podcast because it's just something I've always done. I find it to be a hard habit to break. But I also have... like both justified that and found a new interest in the podcast. But whereas it used to be my entry into politics, my understanding of a political language, and I will always appreciate what it did for me there as being an on-ramp to other things. But I now find it interesting to listen to because of the world we now live in that it being an establishment center-left podcast that is struggling with like a wanting to be a voice for like the left when it increasingly finds itself out of step with where the left is going. And I think it's worthwhile, even if it's not, I don't consider it to be a both sidesism, to be curious to be say, what is the conversation like over there? What are those people talking about? It's not because I value, it's not part of my own values of like where my politics are going, but there is worth, and maybe this is part of just me being a reporter and like just being curious, but like, I'm curious to say, how are they talking about Ocasio-Cortez? How are they talking about Medicare for All? Both because it is informative for how the left is going to push that agenda, how the like, and so I just find it interesting to listen to now because it is a particular type of person in a particular moment in which it is wildly out of step, and yet there are so many people that are from that ignoring like how they are thinking and framing things is at our own peril for making those accomplishments. And so that's what I listen to week for week, is like when I see where the left is going, I'm curious, like this is like a marker of like, well, where is that conversation in different parts? And so it's a different reason for listening. I am not getting any real like occasionally stuff from Bazelon, occasionally stuff from Dickerson. I often find actually Dickerson is way more interesting in his Whistle Stop podcast, in which he is used at his best, where he is like guiding you through history. I'm certainly ideology plays a part in like what parts of history you do and don't talk about, but I think he generally does a pretty good job about topics that I don't know very much about in generations prior. But yeah, that is where I stand. Like if this bring of this topic was about like where I stand on this podcast, this is where I now land. Is like, it used to be something I got a lot rhetorically and intellectually out of. I now find it just to be like an interesting conversational marker at a moment where everything is changing.
It has been so useful to me in the last few years to have the plots, really, like the whole show, but specifically plots, because he and I agree at a fundamental level about something, which is the necessity for government right now, at least. One day, you know, wave my red and black flags and it will all come crumbling down and the state will dissolve and the people will rise, etc. But for now, I grew up, I am a biracial child. My dad is black. My mom is white. My mom was kicked out of her family home for marrying my father. My parents divorced, and my mom had brain surgery when I was 7. She had a thing called an arteriovenous malformation, which is like – I think of it as a tumor. It's a collection of arteries and veins in her brain, and they put a drill in her skull to remove it. And it left her with the inability to see parts of her vision, a susceptibility to seizures, and a general state of fatigue for decades. She's still recovering from it in some ways. And so she was a single mom at this time, right? She was a single parent. To some degree, we did, you know, the family helped. We moved back to Pennsylvania to her mother's place. I lived with my grandmother for a while. We were living in an apartment at the time, and our landlord, fuck landlords, but our landlord at the time let her keep the apartment rent-free for 7 months. And just left our stuff there. So like, yeah, to some degree, you can rely on the kindness of people in your life. I think that compassion and empathy are an important thing that we should develop as individuals. But what we needed was disability, was Medicaid and Medicare. What we needed were, even before that, while my parents were splitting, we relied on institutions like women's shelters to house us when we did not have places to go. We needed child support from my father. Like, these are things that institutions, the government, has a role to play to help those on the margins. A social safety net is a thing that you need a government to provide right now before the state dissolves and the people rise up. And so in this moment, like David Plotz, I believe in the government. The right absolutely does not believe in the government, except for when it can draw, you know, new pathways to profit for corporations who have filled their pockets. I believe in government. I just believe in a different government than David Plotz, who wants one where people are having backroom deals, where they're producing a marketplace of both ideas and commerce. One where the world will guide the government's job is to set a stage for the world to function on. I want a government that cares for people who are in positions of economic and personal and health weakness, a government that does not only allow people to succeed in life, but encourages and enables them. I want a world in which a government who is not driven by profit motive can do things that aren't profitable but are good. With a capital G, good. Provide education, provide healthcare, provide the ability for people to connect to other people in the world so they can understand what the world is. And like David Plotz, like basically just wants a group of people who can, I don't know, pass the occasional bill to reduce your taxes or to make it so that, like, there are better books in your school, which, like, okay, sure.
It's the definition of, like, incrementalism.
Absolutely.
Which it gets marginally better, but mostly on the surface, and is nothing close to radical change or radical rethinking of the status
Plotz
quo.
Is the,
because
he's the best argument against reformism, right? He's the best argument against incrementalism. He's the best argument against we can fix this bit by bit, part by part, because sometimes the rest of the thing falls apart more quickly than you can repair the past.
Well, and he
go ahead.
And he will always invite a saboteur into the conversation. He will always be like, there's always a place at the table for a sensible, responsible conservative in the mold of George W. Bush. And yes, to pull that off, I need to have consistent and progressive amnesia about the arc of political history and the evolution of the Republican Party. But nevertheless, I'm going to do that. And so on any given day, on any given issue, history starts now. Mm-hmm. And we're going to find whichever Republican has not outed themselves as a virulent racist yet. So Kevin D. Williamson out, David French in, I guess. And we're going to pretend like those folks also are going to speak in good faith and are going to have the best interests of those same groups at heart. They want to achieve good ends. They just disagree about how.
Yeah, and I guess like my last point would be like after what you just said, Austin, is that I think maybe what I've grown to realize over the course of this conversation and like rethinking the podcast is that I like was guilty and did believe in the notion of like incrementalism and things can get better. And like, that's like the summation of the Obama presidency and why I started like getting into paying attention to our politics. And then something like 2016 happens and it turns out, oh fuck, we wasted 8 years of power. We will never have 60 votes in the Senate ever again. We fucked up.
Yeah.
And if there is a moment for change, it is not expanding healthcare at the margins. It is like revolutionizing how we conceive of servicing society and the people. And like, that's my own change. And like, that's like the change you don't see in that podcast. And like, I think that maybe more specifically illustrates my own personal like shift on what that podcast is and represents to me.
Yep.
All right, we're going to take a little break and then we'll be back with the other half of Waypoints in a moment.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Okay, but can we talk about the chocolate cookies thing real quick? Just
real
before
quick.
We get to the
real
Browns.
Real quick.
The chocolate cookies, the Cleveland Browns?
Let's go brownies. We're talking about brownies now. We're not talking about cookies.
Brownies,
all right,
yeah.
What's the cookie thing,
fair.
Rob? You link me to a cookie
thing.
Yeah, please, I'm already
please read this quote.
It.
Okay, so the moment I knew I needed to eject from the GabFest came back in like 2008, summer 2008.
Right as I got on board.
Yeah, a decade ago. Look, mid-2000s Patrick sounds like he sucked, not going to lie. That dude sounds shitty. But anyway, so mid-2000s, just as Patrick is discovering politics are a thing, David Plotz is there with Emily Bazelon, and they're doing their sort of their waypoints, their cocktail chatter at the end of the podcast where they bring up stuff they're interested in. And
they've been hoisted on their – we're doing this partially because there's a line from cocktail chatter, Slate Political Gabfest,
100%.
To Match 3 to us.
Then
to waypoints, by the way.
To waypoints.
Because that was the other
hoisted.
I'm sorry. And the Idle Weekend, because that was Chris Remo's idea. He was like,
right.
I love cocktail chatter. We should just go with that. So.
Anyway.
Anyway, point is. So, and I remember this article. In 2008, the New York Times runs this article about people trying to hack together the greatest chocolate chip cookie recipe in the world. And it's just a trivial little, like, food and dining, feature about all these, like, you know, patissiers and chefs working together trying to figure out, like, how can we just make the, like, most kick-ass chocolate cookie in the history of humanity. And they go to all these iterations. It's a fun little article. Bazelon brings it up, and she's kind of put off by just the amount of... She's like the hedonism of it all. Like, the effort being put in to improve and perfect something that fundamentally is just good and simple. Why are we basically like turning this into a science experiment to improve something that's already great? Cookies are already great. The Gabfest. Anyway. But David Plotz just can't handle it. He is furious that this article exists, that like people are thinking about this. And he says at the end of this episode, the amount of intellectual energy that is devoted to food or food science is staggering. It's a huge intellectual indulgence. And these people who would be better spent being engineers, building better telemetry for rockets or something, are instead spending all this time perfecting the way to do sous vide pork belly. I find it slightly offensive, the amount of intellectual energy that goes into food these days.
They think and history can be solved, Rob. They think that everything can be solved. There is a perfect chocolate chip cookie that has already been made. Culture shouldn't just keep happening.
Yeah, just give up. Like, you got a perfectly good chocolate chip cookie. Stop thinking about trying to make it better. Who cares? And the other thing that I just find revealing, and these people who would be better spent being engineers. Uh-huh. Yes, obviously he's misspeaking. But the slip there, I just find riveting. Because this whole idea of, look, if you're a bright, capable person, you owe it to our society to do some sort of technical task that will advance humanity. Now, David Plotz doesn't know what that task could be. Rockets need telemetry, right? Sure, that seems like a thing. David Plotz has definitely devoted his considerable intellectual energy toward contemplating how people should spend their brain cells.
Rockets, like what you shoot at people or escape from a post-climate disaster world in, you know?
Yeah.
Rockets.
But just the entire thing of, like, people trying to live their lives and make an indulgence just a little bit, like, better and more fun was offensive to Plotz. Like, he was basically like, hey, Kenji Lopez Alt, get back get back in the science minds, you bastard.
God, it's amazing.
The All state right. requires your talents, comrade.
God, all right, what are we doing next? What are we... Speaking of wasted potential and talent.
What are you talking about? This I got a path to the wild card.
They do. This is so fucking good. This is so good. Okay. So my waypoint this week.
Me too.
Is this latest season of HBO's Hard Knocks, which is at this point kind of a long-running documentary football series that every year they follow through training camp.
Documentary is, let's put it in quotes, it is approved by the NFL, so our insight is slightly muted, but it is more than you get otherwise in terms of like how an NFL organization actually works.
Yeah. And so this year's edition was the 2018 Cleveland Browns. And I don't know what it was like to watch this week to week, but I'm coming into it now from what we know now. And
it's a lot more interesting now than it was at the time. I'll say that.
Yeah, there is a way in which these shows can seem a bit like NFL propaganda. You know, here's how this team and all these experts are getting better and always improving. Here's what it's like to be on a hard-hitting practice squad in the NFL. This season, they're following the Browns, and the important thing to know about the Browns is last year they won no games. We talked about this a little bit on an earlier Waypoints, about how this is a legendarily tormented fan base.
And they won a single game the year before?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And importantly, during these legendarily bad runs, which I mean is for more than a decade, but like specifically in the last couple of years, it's been really, really bad. Like going 0-16 is like statistically difficult.
Yeah, they went like,
it's actually hard to be that bad in a league that has tried to engineer parity across teams.
It was 650 days without a win or something. It's like mostly, almost 2 years.
It's like the last year they actually wanted them to lose because there were corporations who were prepared to sponsor an 0-16 parade, and then they won a game at the end of the year, and I think they still got the parade, but it was not nearly as fun as an 0-16 parade.
So the other thing is these really, like, these catastrophically bad seasons. Again, they've had a decade of being a bad team. But these catastrophically bad seasons happened under this head coach, Hugh Jackson. And so where this picks up is actually Hugh Jackson sort of throwing this little public event to put the past behind. It's a fresh start for the Cleveland Browns. They're going to change the culture in Cleveland. They're going to become a good football team this year. And there's cause for optimism. One is that they brought in one of the best receivers in the NFL, Jarvis Landry. And it's not so important that you know, like, that you be super into football. You can enjoy this without being super into football because it's just a fascinating portrait of people in an organization mm-hmm. in difficult times.
Just characters.
Jarvis Landry is a legit superstar.
Bless him.
Bless him.
Bless him.
Bless him.
You got to bless him. That's one of his ticks is he's out there because he views his gifts as coming from the Lord. Every time he fucking burns down a defensive back, he has blessed him. He has blessed him with his gifts, which is a pretty awesome thing to
An
say.
An interesting way of looking at it. It's like God smited this defensive bless back, him. But Jarvis Landry, bless him.
But Jarvis Landry is like a legit superstar. He's showing up to this team. They've also just drafted, and this is where the episode begins. They have just drafted this young quarterback, Baker Mayfield, who everyone is expecting great things from. Could be maybe one of those like generational quarterbacks. That's kind of the hope that the Browns have. But on the other hand, this is a coaching staff that has been sort of historically unsuccessful. And there is a kind of lingering whiff of failure and doubt around the Browns. And the thing to know at this point is that this story doesn't have a happy ending. This turnaround doesn't really come off. Not for all the characters in the story. Hugh Jackson, a lot of those coaches you meet, they will be fired at the midway point of the season. But if you're watching this documentary today, it is watching these guys put in motion the final catastrophe that will cost them their jobs and cause a final, like, reckoning in Cleveland. And I think that makes this documentary just fascinating. Because, like, mid-season moves like that are kind of rare. You don't have that many guys getting fired. This year's been an outlier. You're getting a lot of guys fired mid-season in the NFL. But in general, they let you play out the season. They you know, it's like you put the company line out there and you pretend things are going to be fine. Cleveland did not do that. They imploded.
Which we've talked about privately, I think, in terms of there's like a great metaphor at play here when this happens in real life, or it's one that I've begun deploying since you used it regarding a different situation, which is firing your head coach in the middle of an NFL season is sort of like giving you cover to be bad for the rest of the year. It's like, oh, well, you know, we knew the rest of this year was going to be a building year. We fired the coach. It's only halfway over, but we're just going to kick it down the road now. Next year is the real year that we have to care about. And so it was, which is normally what happens. Normally you fire the coach, everything goes bad from there because bringing in a new coach and building a new system, it's like getting rid of a boss and bringing in a new boss who wants to run things their way. And like all of a sudden, like, okay, well, they have to learn everything that's here. They have to build relationships. They have to start things from the ground up. Whatever year you hire a new boss, it's going to be, you know, one full time unit away at least until they can really start making changes. But that doesn't seem to have what happened here was that the team just got better. And you can, it is so hard to go back and watch this first episode in some ways, which is what I watched, because one, Hugh Jackson is, are you too familiar with the term herb? It's like a black culture, hip hop culture thing. Like, oh, that motherfucker is a herb. It's just like corny. It's just like a nerd, like a dork. Just like he a herb, and Hugh Jackson's a herb. Like no, there is no presence. And I think presence is a broad term. I want to be clear. Mm-hmm. I don't mean chest thumping masculinity here. I don't mean like he's quiet. Because there's a sense of quiet presence that you get from some NFL coaches where they don't need to be yelling and screaming. They don't need – and that comes through constantly. But also, to be clear, this first episode is also – comes on a week where his mother dies, which is 2 weeks after his brother dies.
It's brutal.
It's brutal. And there's a sequence early on where he's doing like the morning meeting with his other coaches, and he's just like – by the way, just so you guys know, my mom died last night.
And their heads all whip around.
they whip around, but then they look back forward at the footage that they're all looking at. And there's this moment where you can tell that he just wants like a hug. He just wants any response. And one of them goes like, "Yeah, that's tough. It's real tough." And he goes, "I lost my brother and my mother within 2 weeks of each other. It's crazy, man. Anyway, so this is an inside zone." And it's just like, oh!
So one of the things that I think is particularly, like, I'm watching this with my partner. And yeah. I think one of the things she and I both worked on for ourselves over the years is just trying to get better at, like, different modes of empathy and identifying with people and responding yeah. to the energy they're putting out, the needs they have. Because there's no one given way to interact with people that shows empathy and expresses support. Like, you just have to sound that out. But it requires, like, you should always be trying, like, I generally have the view that, like, I'm always trying to improve, if not my emotional intelligence, at least my ability to sense what people are putting out and, sure. like, the way they want that responded to, what will be welcome in that moment. Football's an incredibly psychological game. You can't play, like, I don't know that anybody can play a game of football and be completely, like, you know, an Iceman-type figure. I don't know that you can play it without heart. Like, it is such a grueling game. And it's a game that, like, is really good at sowing a lot of self-doubt. It can blow your confidence apart. That's something you're going to see affecting a lot of these players as training camp goes on, when you start to feel like, maybe I don't got it. Maybe I don't got it this year. Maybe it's getting away from me.
Especially like the like the undrafted free agents, and like folks are coming in just to get a roster yeah. spot. And like Hard Knocks is my favorite arcs on any of the seasons. And this one in particular has some good ones, where you have those folks who are coming in off the street. They weren't big high draft picks where like they could be a bust, but they're still going to be around for 4, 5, 6 years. These dudes who are just like, you know, maybe they played in college, maybe they're off the street and they're just trying to get a spot, and like they'll follow them as they almost inevitably get cut because they almost rarely make the roster.
There's a moment about 40. I want, you know, okay, so one, this episode's just on an HBO channel.
Well,
like,
just
look
real
it up.
Quick, let me just finish my
please.
Point that I was going
yeah,
to.
Yeah, yeah,
go just on. I think one of the things that comes through in the show is this is a game that so many of these guys, these coaches, these players need empathy, emotional support. They yes. need emotional intelligence around them. But culturally, just like just everything that surrounds football, but particularly this organization is particularly bad at this. They are just an environment where that stuff is lacking. And so moments of outreach are missed, and then people try to back it up and circle back and provide the empathy that they missed earlier. And that also feels forced. And like the excruciating thing about this show, but that makes it like, again, just utterly captivating to watch, is all these moments where you can see a world where these things turned out differently, mm-hmm. where the right thing is said, where people are given what they need to succeed at a given moment. And this group of people at the Browns almost unerringly miss that fucking cue. And the result is almost always some sort of lingering damage.
You know, there are so many times in the show where someone says, like, what's it all about? It's all about family. It's all about family. We're a family here. And like, are you? Because no one got up and hugged that man when he said he lost two family members in 2 weeks. Like,
but then he's just having his mourning later on in the show. And the general manager of the team plus another coach, or another exec, they walk in just uninvited, just unannounced. They walk in and they're like, let's hug it out. Just let it out.
You gotta let it out.
Because you know your mom died, right? Your mom's dead. Just let it out. You should probably cry now.
And you know that, like, if you don't get over this, you know that I'm the new GM, and that if you don't have a winning season, like, you're gonna get fired. So
get it out of your system.
I mean, that's always what must in some ways like lead to this lack of empathy, right? Like, is the actual way these teams are structured, the power dynamics that exist between like these people. Like, so yeah, when Jack Dorsey, the GM, comes in and like, yeah, wants to hug it out with Hugh Jackson, it's like, well, I mean, if you've been following like the narratives of football, like, you know that Hugh is like a dead man walking. Like, there's almost no way that he comes out of here with a job unless he makes it to the playoffs. And so, like, why would this GM want to even build an empathetic relationship with a man that he's going to inevitably fire, whether at the end of the season or midway this season? And so it's just, it's fucking weird.
There are moments in the show that are, that, you know, you talk about, like, on one hand, you have these people who are going through something. Like, football training camp is incredibly hard. Like, it is just grueling work day after day, and hoping that it will be enough down the road. And even in that first episode, there are signs where, like, a lot of the other coaches are like, this isn't going to do it. Like, people aren't giving their all. There are moments when people are just, like, on the sidelines not practicing in fisherman hats, just, like, chatting, barely listening to what's going on. There's this really stirring moment where Jarvis Landry gets up during a kind of receivers-only coaching segment. Kind of off, like an offensive group kind of tape watching thing. And he's like, yeah, I got something to say. Like, if you're going to fucking be at practice, be at practice. Fucking practice. And the number one thing that he says, the thing that he keeps coming back to is like the lackadaisical nature, the fact that no one's giving their all, the fact that people have already bought in that they're the Browns, that they're going to lose, they don't have to practice, is contagious. This feeling of being a failure is contagious. And like, Lord, do I know what that is. Like, absolutely do I know that feeling of like, well, we're probably going to come up, you know, win a 3 or 4 games this season no matter what. Okay, well, you know, this article's probably only going to do 5, 6, 7,000 hits. Yeah. You know,
Stroll
in a little later, leave a little earlier.
And where Jarvis comes in, there's this moment, it's like him realizing what he's gotten himself into, where he's like, I don't know what the fuck has been going on. I don't know why things are this way. But it needs to stop. Like, every time you're dogging it at practice, that means the guys who are showing up have to work harder, and they're going to get hurt.
Yep.
Like, more is going to be asked of them, they're going to get fucking hurt, and once one of them goes down, the others carry even more weight. So get out there and practice. But, like, there's things in this show that, like, there's a moment, it's hilarious, but, like, there's two players standing on the sideline,
yeah,
and they're doing that I'm not seeing you thing to their coach, Hugh Jackson. One of them
to
is,
their
like,
head
sort
coach.
Of shading his eyes so he can't see his head coach staring at him. And they're mic'd up, so you hear one of them say, like, he's looking at me right now, isn't he? The guy's like, yeah, dog. He's like, he's locked on, baby. He's like, I'm not going to look at him. It's so good, but it's so childish. And, like, how is this happening?
The tragedy...
Does this first episode... Go ahead.
The tragedy is... Then Hugh Jackson looks over at them. He's like, are you guys listening? What play did he just call? What did he say? And they're like, like a nickel package over alpha. And he's like, yeah, you should listen. And like, oh, Hugh, you're a disaster. Like, I know it's a hard week. And I'm not saying he should be doing a better job. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I'm not saying, like, I'm shocked he's there. I would not be there that week. And yet, also, there's also a meeting later where Hugh tries. He has like the head coach meeting. He's like the coach meeting with.
Oh, this was
you describe it, Pat. He has all the coaches there. All the coaches there.
There's like the setup is like he's in his chair, sort of at the front, and then all the other coaches. You know, you got the offensive line coach, the offensive coach. You know, like everyone, all the coaches that are under his tree.
You don't know about football. Like, there's a bunch of coaches. There's a head coach, but then there's a coach that just works with linebackers. There's a coach who just works with
quarterbacks, tight ends.
And then there's an offensive coach who works with all those sub coaches. There's like a dozen coaches for any.
It's like
team.
A military general staff. Like, there's the head of your Air Force. There's the, like, go down to every position. There's somebody whose job it is to make sure that guy can do his job.
Yes.
Patrick, right. This awesome
so,
meeting.
So Hugh, you know, being the head coach is on one side, and then everyone else is lined up. And then I forget their offensive coordinator's name because he got fired a couple of weeks back. Haley, who came from the Steelers. And he pushes back on Hugh. Like, what was the exact thing that he was pushing back on?
Working guys hard in practice, wasn't it?
Yeah, he sees it. He's like, we got a long way to go.
We have a culture problem.
Yeah, it's a culture problem. Exactly. Like, people aren't working as hard as they need to. We need to go a further way than we have time to go.
And you need to do that early in practice camp, just by the way. Like, you emphasize conditioning early on because, like, as the season gets closer, you need to be doing the more advanced stuff. You need to be, like, game planning.
Right. And so, like, a pretty reasonable thing to suggest. And, like... Hugh hired this guy, right? So you're hiring people, theoretically, to give you, like, feedback and criticism about, you know, how things are going. And Hugh he sits back and if you ever want to see someone try to pull a power move and fail at it and get uncomfortable the longer the attempt goes on, then watch this scene because he basically is like, hey, I'm in the big chair. You're not in the big chair. I'm making this sound more powerful than you are. Did. But he tries to like when you're in the big chair, you can make the big boy.
He doesn't
decision.
Even say it.
You want to be a big boy, come.
He eventually says like, hey, Andrew, I forget what the other guy's name is. He's like, what's that thing you always say? When you can make the calls when it's your team. That's right. I make the calls when it's my team. I'm driving the bus. You're in the bus. I hired you, so I'm going to listen to what you said, but I'm driving the bus. And it all just, there's like seven beats. And then Haley is like, yeah, on another note, I think we've made good progress, I guess.
And you just watch all these fucking NFL coaches, like all who look like their cholesterol is through the fucking roof. Like every one of these guys like looks like they might just be about to faceplant midway through any rant on the sideline. Just
listen,
so
man.
All of them as Hugh Jackson.
Cleveland
talking.
Has good food.
Yeah, there's some body skyline chili just like about to like just block an artery anymore. But like all these guys just turning like florid, just like it is a row of like purple and pink faces as they listen to Hugh Jackson explain why, you know, maybe it does look like these players who patently don't give a fuck during practice. Maybe it looks when you're in that chair, the little man's chair, why that's a bad thing. But when you're sitting in the big chair, you know, obviously it looks different.
Well, and I'm sympathetic to him. I think there's a bad power play. It falls apart. There are times when you know that he knows. There's a bit early on when he is, you know, one of the plot lines of the Cleveland Browns. One of the plot lines in football that happens a lot is veteran mid-tier quarterback is the starter, and then up-and-coming rookie who is a great player, has a lot of potential, needs to kind of vie for that starter position. When does that handoff happen? Because if it happens too early, they're not poised enough, they're not comfortable enough, and they could get hurt or they could lose their confidence and become kind of a much lower tier quarterback than you hope. If it happens too late, then they go cold. Then they've lost the momentum from coming off of a college game, from being the superstar, and now they're kind of like a mid-tier quarterback again. And so it's like a good coach can walk that line and find the right moment to pull in that rookie and make them the lead. And that can happen in the first year, that can happen during training camp, but it's about when is it? And so you see some of that here with Hugh meeting with Baker Mayfield and being like, so what time did you get to the field today? And he's like, oh, you know, it depends on the day. You know, I do a workout. And he's like, okay, well, when does Terrell was their last guy? Was the
Terod.
Last Terod, right? And so he's like, what time does he come through? And he goes, well, he does a whole morning exercise by himself. And he's like, well, Bake, you got to do that, basically. Like, you should start doing that also. What's your morning exercise routine? And it's just like very – it is a moment of smart coaching. And so you know he knows, but he can't quite deliver the punch. He can't quite, like, actually make the demand. And I'm sympathetic to that. It is hard to be bad cop. It is hard to, like, walk into the room and be like, no, do fucking better. Because that also doesn't always get results. That's the other thing, right? Sometimes you can be the person who was like, God damn it, no, show up. And especially with a young quarterback, you risk ruining that relationship. Which, I mean, their relationship gets ruined no matter what this year anyway.
Well, yeah, that's one of the reasons Hugh Jackson has shown the door. Is because, like, and you start to see it happening over this documentary. Like, Mayfield starts to pick up that, like, there's a weird vibe around so much about this team. And, like, after a point, like, he knows he's a young star. He knows, like, it's going to be his team in the future. And there's a point where you can start to sense, even toward the end of training camp, he's starting to realize his interests are diverging from those of the coaching staff. That, like...
Well, and there's a vacuum of leadership, right? Like, that's ultimately what takes the Hugh down. Like, is not... I mean, the loss is yes, but... It's the lack of any sort of like vision or leadership. And I think that's probably like the most interesting thing about this whole season. The show is viewing it through the lens of the coach, and like, and this is probably applicable like broader to like management and like how you lead a team is like how do you lead? Like, what does that even mean? What is the balance between being friends with people and being their managers? How do you have that? When is it the soft touch and when is it like the punch on the arm?
Well, and this
like,
is such a
you show people the door.
This is such a trick too, because like Hugh Jackson, you start to realize like he may not have any of the stuff you need to actually do this. He just may not be that, but he definitely hasn't figured out what works for him. He has not figured out his style, and at this point, he probably never will. He does not have what it takes to be a head coach. There's many models you can adopt. There are people who, you know, the Phil Cowher style, you know, brilliant football tactician will also just like scream so loud that like the paint will be blistered off the walls in the opposing team's locker room. You know, you'd have that model. Or this season, I think in Chicago, we got a great coach, Matt Nagy, who seems to have just a really like good down in the trenches, you know, shoulder to shoulder with the guys vibe. There's a lot of different models of this. There's a lot of different modes, but you have to find one that works and you have to be able to execute it. And I think the really bleak thing watching Hugh Jackson is that you just watch him try these different approaches and just whiff on all of them. And yeah. You're watching the players. They know it. Everyone knows it. And increasingly people are just trying to work around him. And it is a really interesting thing to watch because you know that no matter what story this documentary is trying to tell, in the end, this is not going to turn around. It's not coming back.
And it's fascinating to watch. I think when you watch a football game, like as bad as a team might be, like in your head, like, oh, these are a bunch of professionals, like athletes at the top of their game. They're always putting in the work. Like they're always like, these are just professionals. And what's interesting about this documentary, and this is also true, I think there's one from a couple years ago when Jeff Fisher was the coach of the Rams
one.
Before Sean McVay came in.
Winning
yeah,
is everything.
Well, I didn't watch the Amazon one. They did a Hard Knocks one, and then they did an Amazon one, which apparently was a lot better than the Hard Knocks one. Actually, no, the Hard Knocks one was when it was still the St. Louis Rams before they went to L.A. Anyway, I completely lost my train of thought.
Well, Jeff Fisher, legendary shitty coach. Just, probably yes. Like first ballot, Hall of Fame, bad at coaching, kept getting jobs.
Yes. No, it was that what's interesting is to watch, like, it's that players, I mean, they're being lazy, but not because they're lazy. It's like interesting to watch professionals, like unbelievable athletes, just
they have
not
no
care.
Motivation,
like become disinterested,
which is
they have no,
the
like,
goal of a good coach or a good boss or a good, you know, a parent is like recognizing potential and recognizing skill and talent and athleticism and being like, all right, now I'm going to give you a vision so that every step you know why you're doing this. And they try to do that at the end of the first episode with the, like, what is your why? And it does, like, the HBO original fade out with music playing and, like, solemn shots of people writing family or, like, my mom on index cards or on loose sheets of paper. And it's, like, fine. It's fine. But it's not the same thing as, like, you know, something about – there's a sequence early on where Jarvis just kind of, like, does a great one-handed catch. And someone is like, Jarvis is fucking good. And – the thing that is like, yes, he is good. He is good at catching the ball. He is good at – he's a great receiver. But he also wants to play the game. He wants to be good. And this is – I want to be careful to not fall into the trap of what Felix Biederman was doing in the MMA in the Fighting in the Age of Loneliness. What is it? Fighting in the Age of Loneliness?
Yeah, Fighting in the Age of Loneliness.
Thing, which is like, oh, and he just wants it more. But the reason he wants it seems to be internal. He wants to be a good wide receiver. He wants to be a great wide receiver. Other players want to play football, but they're not being – no one has given them that, this is why you need to play football well. This is why you should want to be a great wide receiver. And part of a coach's job is to produce that desire so that from the beginning of training camp, you are engaged. You are on fire. Like every play, every practice run, everything you do matters, and it is hard to communicate that.
So I'm going to say something that's ridiculously flattering to Joel, our Joel.
Yeah.
When I play PUBG with that guy,
yeah,
I become 50 times the PUBG player I am normally. And part of it is because he just knows what the fuck he's about. He's good at this game.
Yeah.
He will steer things in a direction that, like, you will not be in a position where it is possible for you to fuck up the way you normally do. He will set you up in positions where you can succeed. But the thing is, like, good players, good leaders can do that stuff. They put you in positions where you can taste excellence, where you can be like, if I do my part, I don't have to carry this entire thing. I can do my part, and I can be excellent at my part, and we will succeed together. And Jarvis Landry is excellent in himself. He's pursuing it, like he embodies it, but he wants to share it with his team. He wants to be surrounded by excellence. And where you begin to see the friction cropping up is like he's doing what he can with the receiver core. And you start to see it later episodes. It starts to catch on with the defensive secondary as well as they play against him. Like, yeah, tempers get up, but like people are raising their game around Jarvis Landry because like he demands it and he expects it. But every other aspect of this Browns organization, you get the sense people don't have faith that, like, you know, the difference between busting your ass or half-assing it,
yeah.
it's going to be the same either way. Hugh ain't getting you that W.
You know what? I think you're very close to being right here, but I think there's one thing that you're – it isn't just the whole – there's someone else who's really busting their ass in the organization who's really trying to make something happen there. It's just like it's inspiring to see Brogan Roback.
Oh, my God.
Fourth-string quarterback of – he's the backup quarterback.
Which means he's on the practice squad. He's not even actually on the roster.
No, 100% not there for real. I looked into it. I went to his Wikipedia page, which, you know, shout outs to you, Brogan. Roback played college football at Eastern Michigan, where he saw action in 46 games with 745 completions for 8,653 yards and 57 touchdowns. Awesome. Second line, he saw action as a punter. That professional career, Cleveland Browns. He signed as an undrafted free agent on May 14th, 2018. He was released on August 31st, 2018. Most recently, he worked out with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And I know that in football, the phrase worked out with means something. It suggests, like, the first steps of a relationship that could turn into a career. But if your Wikipedia page is like, oh, who'd you last work out with? Like, it's telling if you're a professional athlete what that suggests. But that motherfucker has a presence. You first see him in there's a kind of a serious scene ends, and it cuts to – it's not a serious scene. It's Baker Mayfield singing Country Roads in front of the rest of the team, because it's like his turn to sing in front of the team, you know. Got to let it all down. You're one of us now. He says how much his signing bonus was, $7.7 million, and then, like, says how much – and then he's like, sing a song.
I love the people – we want that guaranteed shit. We want to know the real, like, how much money are you actually getting?
Yeah. And then Hugh is like, all right, now sing a song in front of everybody. They'll join in. Pick a song. He's like, someone tell me what song. He's like, just pick a song. They'll join in. And he's like, Country Road. And no one comes in. No one does. He sings half a verse and sits down. And then it cuts to the RV, the quarterback RV. There's an RV where the quarterbacks stay. They don't stay at home. They don't stay in a hotel nearby. They stay in an RV outside of training camp. And Brogan Roback, which sounds like a fake name I would come up with, is this, like, bleach blonde, like, wearing slippers motherfucker who is in the middle of, like, loading in groceries or something into this RV. And he goes, people keep tweeting me nonstop asking me, is Brogan allowed in the RV? Is Brogan allowed in the RV? You know, I'm saying, last time I checked, I was a QB2. I come in here every single night. I check the fridge. I restock it. I lay the snacks out. And if I don't lay things out the right way and the presentation is poor, they'll have my ass. He's like, I talked to our nutritionist lady to ask her. He's like, I thought I was going to get good snacks like Oreos and Pop-Tarts. But they said, no, they want healthy snacks. So I talked to the nutritionist lady. I said, give me all the healthy snacks. And he is just, he gives a tour of the QB RV. He's like, well, this is a room. So this is where, you know, Baker sleeps. And over here, you know, the starter. And then, and he's like, you know, I sleep here sometimes, or, and he points on the ground, somewhere around here on the ground, maybe. He's like a poor puppy. It's amazing. I have to imagine he recurs throughout the rest of the season.
Oh, yeah, he's a breakout, like, star of the show.
Someone hire that guy.
I mean, until he gets cut.
Right, well, like, he should just go to ESPN. Like, he should just be hosting something. He is hilarious. It's 37 minutes in. Just watch that clip. You can find it online. It's extremely good.
Yeah.
I think my remains my all-time favorite sort of, like, fuck the culture of this team indictment. I mean, maybe I remember this because it's related to the NFC North, but so Calvin Johnson, one of the all-time wide receivers, like, just unbelievable talent. Like, he will go to the Hall of Fame despite only playing 4 or 5 seasons. He left partially because he left a year early, partially because he was trying to negotiate getting out of the Lions doing an extension because he'd had some injuries, but it was the kind of things he could have played through. He could have kept playing, and even though he was hobbled, he was so big and so dominant that he was the kind of guy you could literally just lob a ball up to.
His nickname was Megatron, and that was no joke.
Megatron. Yeah, he was an I hated the Lions. I hate the Lions, but he was so much fun to watch. And he, when he eventually like sort of abruptly just like stopped negotiating with the Lions and just up and left, he did this exit interview where like someone asked him like, so, like, what happened? Like, usually when players leave, like, you know, because he was always with the Lions. He was drafted by the Lions, wasn't with any other team. Like, usually that kind of historical precedent means that, like, you know, you're going to be nice to the organization. You'll get your jersey retired at some point. He says, like, why would I stick around and risk getting injured when we're never going to the Super Bowl? Like, that team was going nowhere. Why should I stick with them? And it was just, yeah. I was wow.
You just like, said it, huh?
Damn. Yeah. All right. Like, and then imagine, like, that guy, probably one of the leaders in the locker room, and then, like, that whole team has to go out and just
don't
go play
the game.
Just
someone, someone got to say it.
Beautiful.
Like, yeah. and that's ultimately where the Browns end up, right? Like, this is what sounds like what derailed them midseason is things got, like, completely broken down between Todd Haley, the offensive coordinator, and the coach. But
well, Haley wanted Hugh fired, and Hugh wanted Haley fired. So the GM said, you're both
fired. And he promotes the defensive coordinator who might retain that job.
Greg Williams, Jesus Christ. No,
I know.
Don't do that.
The thing that makes the most sense is they hired
Greg Williams sucks.
The Packers. They just fired their head coach McCarthy. I could see that working yep. out. But
Bruce Arians also said he wants to go.
The
there.
Weird thing that I do want to sound a note of caution about this is it is easy to watch these documentaries and think you know the inside story and you can diagnose from what you have observed as to what is actually going on. Like this documentary, you're never going to see an all 22 camera of Browns games. Like you fundamentally like don't see what their game plans are, how they are breaking down. Like it's a reality show to an extent as much as it's a documentary. And like the thing I always try to remember is years ago HBO ran the series 24/7, and it was about they may not run it anymore, they might still, but we cover two hockey teams leading up to the NHL's Winter Classic, and one of their best seasons was about the Washington Capitals playing the Pittsburgh Penguins. And in that documentary, the Washington Capitals coach, Bruce Boudreau, came across like, what's that, a herb, Austin? Is that?
Yeah, uh-huh, a herb. You got it.
Yeah, this guy seemed like a total herb. Like, just one of the most hapless, like, shit's just gonna, like, fall apart around this guy. His fly will always be down. His car is never going to start. He is always going to spill, like, a, you know, he's always going to spill food on his chest. He's just one of those dudes. And you watch that show and you watch that documentary, and he comes across that way in every scene. And you're like, this guy is a fucking clown. Like, get this guy out of here. You want to know why the Capitals always underperform? It's because this, you know, schmuck is leading them every year. Boudreau is one of the most successful coaches in the NHL. Like, was one of the most successful coaches in the NHL. Like, he was really good at turnarounds. He was really successful. And, like, he had the statistics to back that up. And it is easy in these documentaries to think that, like, all those moments of personal beef and drama, like, are giving you, like, profound insight into why a team doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It's also entirely possible that none of this stuff really matters. And what matters is Hugh Jackson and Todd Haley couldn't scheme an offense to save their fucking lives.
God. Yeah, it's – I am rooting for the Browns this year. I don't want –
Also, how do we overlook the part that there's a scene, I think in the first episode, where there's a dude giving financial advice, and then later, that
Tony
dude was
Robbins
indicted
my idol.
For the advice he's giving doesn't
make
any sense.
Wait, this is the dude?
And it, then,
is that the, he gets,
I think that's the, I'm pretty sure that's
fuck
the
dude. Fuck you, no!
All right, so first of all, the advice he's giving is about compound interest, right? And he's basically saying, oh, we could all be billionaires. By the time we're 65, we could all have infinite money because of the way compound interest works. So you just put this money away. And I'm not saying that you could not have – it is not the same guy. It is not the same guy.
Oh, it's not
Michael
the same
Kendricks
guy.
Was the insider
the
trading. He might have been in that room, though. I don't know. But he was basically saying, like, oh, yeah, you could compound interest is an important thing to understand when investing. But his example ends up being, like, by the time we're retiring, we're at retirement age at 65, blah, 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 blah. But he's acting like you would have invested $1 million the day you were born. He's, like, counting 65 years from age 22 to age 65.
This is one of the other things that is beautiful here is – in the series, like, and this is the thing that speaks very much to me, because, like, when I played football, like, I was a shitty football player, but I played. And, like, I played D&D with a bunch of fucking linemen and shit like that.
Oh,
like,
hell yeah.
The idea of football players just being a bunch of dumb fucking meatheads, like, just isn't true. It's a world like any other. And on a football team, you will often find all types. And this show brings that out. There's a lot of, like, really sweet, gentle dudes. There's a lot of bros. Like, this show captures that. But the thing I love in that scene is this guy's describing, like, yeah, you just get 10% annual returns, compound that annual. You'll be like a billionaire by the time you're 30. There's this lineman just listening to this, and he's like, wait, 10% annual?
Yeah.
So you sure? Like 10%? Like that's 10%. A lot, man.
That's a lot.
And the guy turns around, he's like, "Fuck you. It's easy. You just Tony Robbins. Look it up. Like 10% is easy." He's like, "What? What? No, that 10% is like that's God tier. Like that's where are you getting that?" And the guy's like, "Shut up. I know what I'm doing." And it's this great like. You got this fucking lineman there who, like, actually does have some financial literacy, and he's hearing just absolute bullshit being spouted, and he's, like, trying to hold up his hand, like, wait. It's a great little beat.
That's I do want to at least... Okay, so I was wrong in the insider trading guy being the guy doing that presentation, but, yes, there was a player on the Browns defense who was found guilty of insider trading, was put on... he was banned for 8 games. He was dropped by the Browns the moment he was indicted. He got picked up by the Seattle Seahawks and has been playing for several weeks. And I think he's actually going on IR because he hurt his foot. But he was going to play out the string. He couldn't play in the Super Bowl if the Seahawks got there because that's in February. Because in January, he will be sentenced to up to 25 years in prison. He is going to prison for a quarter of a century, but he's still playing football because he doesn't get sentenced. He doesn't actually go to jail and get sentenced until January. That's wild.
Wait, did they throw the book at him that fucking hard?
He potentially up to 25 years. You know, it'll probably be... 7 years to 4 years, good behavior, blah, 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 blah. But this quote from him, "That part is inevitable and I probably won't speak on that," he said, noting he's focused on staying rooted in the present.
Same.
Yeah. So, you know what? The future doesn't exist, honestly. Burn it all down. Oh,
that was... It's a great documentary. Y'all need to check it out. This season of Hard Knocks is fascinating, especially if you like look up what happened to these dudes. It is a really good documentary. Episode 2 or 3, there's a really sweet chocolate lab that lives in the facility that you meet.
Who's the tight end that's awesome? What's that dude's name?
There's kind of a heartbreaking.
He was good.
Aside with this. Total try-hard tight end who's, like, just almost good enough to make the roster, but, like, isn't. And he has the sweetest story. And, yeah, okay, he's into crystal healing and focusing their energies.
All right.
But also he has the sweetest and most supportive dad.
His dad is dad goals. I want to be that father. Like, that. I looked at that and was like, yes, like, I love you, son, for everything that you are.
Yeah, it was... So it's a really sweet show. I really enjoy it. Prepare some socially social awkwardness as you watch it when you watch Hugh Jackson and his coaching staff try to inspire and lead.
We don't have time for a third waypoint, but because we've spent the last 30 minutes talking about football, then if you're like, but football's evil. And, like, I'm, probably. Go listen to the December 5th episode of Citations Needed, episode 59, National Pastimes. Mindless Militarism in American Sports is a fascinating listen about the relationship between the NFL and the Major League Baseball with the government, specifically as a way of a long-running relationship meant to propagandize the American military, produce, certain sympathies and feelings towards American expansionism and empire. And also, weirdly, some stuff that I had not thought about in terms of monopoly protections that they're allowed to have. That is really fascinating. So, yeah, that's my suggestion.
All right. Well, our thanks to Tumelo for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at tumelomakes.bandcamp.com. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people find you?
At Patrick Klepik.
Austin.
And you can find me at Austin_Walker. Sorry, I'm using Danielle's headphones, and they're bad. And I realized they're terrible. These are terrible headphones. And like, if I turn my head just so, it sounds like you're all in a cave. Anyway, I'm going to talk to her. Yeah, that's exactly what it sounds like.
All right, well, that'll do it for this week's Waypoints. We'll get back to you on that cave headphone situation. In the meantime, we hope you've enjoyed the break. We'll be back again on Friday with Waypoint Radio, and I think we might have one more Waypoint Radio for the year that's sort of regularly scheduled. And then we're going to be moving into...
I don't think that's true. I think next week.
Okay.
Starting Monday.
We'll see how it plays out in terms of the schedule, Austin. That is all I will say
we have them banked. We've recorded like 7 podcasts in the last 2 days. We're
not the ones
it.
We intended to, but yes, it's definitely 7.
The first one we have scheduled, we recorded.
We're good.
But next week.
Yes.
At some point
very soon, the end of year 2018 review podcast will start to kick over, and we will be keeping you company through your holiday break and your visits with your family. So stay tuned for that. But we're also going to circle back and maybe revisit some of our favorite waypoints to see, did Twin Peaks stay weird?
I think so. I don't know why, but I feel like you're trying to throw to me to say, like, we'll have all that and more tonight on Sports Night, so stick around.
All right, well, I realized I just found the perfect ending, which is, did Twin Peaks stay weird? And I just sort of let it hang.
Okay.
But
I didn't
that'll do it for this week's Waypoints. hope you'll join us again, but until then, do not give in to astonishment.
So stick around.
Next on Sports Night.
On Sports, yeah.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.